The next case of the morning is number 04-1943, David Velez against Michael Johnson. Mr. Jones.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court and opposing counsel. As the Court knows, this case arises out of an incident that occurred at the Milwaukee County Jail back in September of 1999, in which the plaintiff, Mr. Velez, was sexually assaulted by his cellmate at the time. Mr. Velez contends that Deputy Johnson, a deputy sheriff with the Milwaukee County Jail, failed to prevent that attack and therefore is liable under the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause. The district court concluded that both on the merits and as to Deputy Johnson's argument on qualified immunity, that summary judgment was not appropriate. Deputy Johnson contends that the district court erred in both respects.
I wanted to make a comment about jurisdiction, Mr. Jones, because it's absolutely clear that we have jurisdiction to entertain the qualified immunity appeal, and I don't think any of us would have any problem with that. But your logic that we should extend pendent appellate jurisdiction to the underlying denial of the summary judgment motion is very troubling to me, because I can't even think of a qualified immunity appeal for which this wouldn't also qualify. It seems to me it would be an enormous opening in the exception, if you will, to the final judgment rule, because obviously a denial of summary judgment isn't normally a final judgment. And I'm not even sure why you need it, because the fact is, on the first prong of the Saucier against Katz test, where we take the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff and ask, is he talking about something that would amount to a constitutional violation, here a 14th Amendment violation? If the answer to that is yes, then we would proceed to the second part and ask about clearly established. If the answer to that is no, you've already won on the qualified immunity appeal, and nothing else is going to happen in the district court. So I'm not sure either why it's necessary, and I'm certainly very uncomfortable doctrinally with going down this pendant appellate jurisdiction route.
Well, certainly I would agree with Your Honor that under the Saucier test, obviously the first part is, if the facts are alleged as true, does that state a constitutional claim?
And I take your whole point. I mean, your position is that it doesn't, because it doesn't show, you know, whatever, enough knowledge or enough deliberate indifference or what have you. And, of course, your opponent is arguing the opposite. So it seems to me we'd be best advised to focus through that lens, if you will, on the issues here.
Well, certainly. And I think whether you are calling it an analysis under qualified immunity in Saucier, or whether you are referring to it as a consideration of the merits of the 14th Amendment claim, ultimately that first part of the qualified immunity standard and the question on the merits is, do these facts, taken in the most favorable to the plaintiff here, establish a constitutional violation? So I guess in part in response to your inquiry, I think you do, in essence, have to get to the merits. And in that respect, while that is a twist on the doctrine that certainly was not present in the Greenwell v. Astar case, it's not opening up the court to a discussion that's broader than what it's already taking on under a qualified immunity analysis.
Okay. So now let me ask you what seems to me to be the key question. In terms of Deputy Johnson's alleged deliberate indifference, I realize that your argument is he gets this, you know, the emergency light illuminates and he hears a statement about a conflict, and instead of doing anything to look into it, he just asks and doesn't get very much additional information. But I wonder why one shouldn't infer that it's, as it were, an emergency conflict. We have to assume, on the facts most favorable to the plaintiff, that this emergency button isn't misused, that it hasn't been misused by Velez or, for the most part, by other inmates at this jail facility. And we certainly know that there is a distressing amount of intra-inmate violence in things. And if somebody in an emergency way says a conflict is unfolding, why isn't that enough to summon the other officers, the other two who are out there making the rounds, who eventually go anyway, to the cell to check it out? Because it seems to me if Officer Johnson had asked the other two, one or more of the other two officers to go, even if they had arrived 5 minutes late, that certainly would not have violated the Constitution. You can't expect people to be perfect, and that would have been enough, just as in all these medical cases. But instead, he just sort of sits there and doesn't do anything, even though he's been notified that there's an emergency conflict.
I would suggest that the court needs to consider two elements. One, both the rest of the contact between Velez and Johnson, and two, the context that communication was taking place in.
Well, that's what I'm trying to do. I mean, when it's an emergency and you hear that there's a conflict in a prison, I mean, people have homemade weapons all the time in prisons. Jail, I should say. But
the record indicates that Johnson's testimony is that Velez indicated to him that he wasn't getting along with his cellmate. Now, Velez's testimony, and obviously the court has to look first to Velez's testimony, taking the facts in the light most favorable to him, is that he informed Johnson not that a conflict was occurring necessarily, but that he was having a conflict with his cellmate.
Well, isn't that Judge Wood's question says you have to infer that there was no abuse of the emergency button and all that, but as a matter of fact, there was no abuse of the emergency button. This is the first time he had used it. He presses the button, and nothing really happens.
There is
evidence. He talks to him, but my God, you're not going to say, get over here right now because this guy's got a razor and he's going to get me. You're supposed to respond quickly to an emergency button, aren't you?
The response.
And if you didn't do it, isn't that a jury question whether you're deliberately indifferent?
I'm sorry, I don't mean to keep interrupting.
No, I'm sorry. I was interrupting you.
The response was, and obviously, perhaps in 2020 hindsight, it's subject to criticism. But this court in particular and other courts have certainly addressed that question in the law enforcement context. But the response was, what is the problem? Officer Johnson didn't do nothing. He responded to the call light, the inquiry over that emergency system. He said, what is happening? What is the problem? The response is either I'm not getting along with my inmate.
Well, no, the response is there's a conflict.
There's a conflict. And then Officer Johnson, taking that little piece of information, says, well, have you asked for a transfer? Velez says, yes. Officer Johnson says, well, you'll need to wait for the classification unit to respond to that request, the unit in charge of that. Taking all that, the totality of those facts, there's no, after the initial emergency call and in the context of that conversation, there's no direct indication from Mr. Velez to the officer that there is, in fact, an emergency. He doesn't follow.
But how can he do that when the button, he's said it's an emergency by using the button at all. And if he has a razor pressed up against his neck, it's not really surprising that he doesn't say, and by the way, my throat is about to be slit, because he's trying to prevent that from happening.
I'm not suggesting that he has to say there's a razor to my jugular. What I'm suggesting is that the courts in the past have looked for a direct indication from the inmate to the officer that there is a threat from a specific source.
Right, and why isn't, as Judge Evans said, the mere fact that he has used the emergency button something to create a jury issue on this?
In the context of a jail where, as this court in Ricardo made clear, officers are asked to make split-second decisions and judge the genuineness of a complaint from an inmate like that.
And so you say we should draw an inference that he's abusing the emergency button is actually what, or that at least there's a substantial probability that he's abusing it.
What I'm suggesting is that based on the entirety of the conversation in that context, it is not reasonable to infer that after Johnson had spoken with Velez, that he knew subjectively that there was a substantial risk of serious harm.
See, you don't get to pick your roommates, and you're double-selling somebody with God knows who, and they've written an emergency button. That means there's an emergency, and you got to respond to it.
I see that my time is out.
Please answer the judge's question.
To respond to your question, even a 911 operator, people call 911 for all kinds of reasons, and that's not even in the jail context. Even a 911 operator is going to ask the person on the other end of the phone, what's going on? And if the information that comes back isn't of a nature to suggest someone's immediately going to get harmed or die, the response is going to vary.
I know, I think that response would be perfect if they were in cells all by themselves, but you're going to put two people in a cell who don't know each other. And I don't even like to stay in the same room at a Holiday Inn with my friends on a golf trip. So, I mean, you're picking people who don't have any choice. They're roommates. And they press an emergency button when they're locked in their cell with somebody that's a stranger to them. Yeah, I think that's a jury question.
Again, my time
no,
is up.
I'm sorry. I should go on. Go ahead. That's enough.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. We'll hear now from Mr. Mishloff.
Thank you. May it please the court, my learned colleagues. Back in 1991, in McGill case, this court said something to the effect of the concept of deliberate indifference gives courts fits. And it made an analogy. It said deliberate indifference is like an ostrich hiding its head in the sand. An ostrich hides its head in the sand when it feels threatened. It doesn't just hide its head in the sand. There has to be something to stimulate that, some threat that it knows of, and then it ignores it. And that's really what happened here. McGill is a great analogy. It's still good law. And that's what happened here. There's kind of a factual dispute here about the significance of the emergency button. And, of course, that has to be taken in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, given the procedural context. But there's also a jurisdictional question raised in Clash v. Beatty about factual disputes and qualified immunity claims.
Except that was before Saucier, though. I mean, now we know what to do with it. We give the plaintiff the benefit of the doubt.
The fact is the context here is the key. I think the courts hit the exact inquiry correctly, and frankly, counsel talks about the context, and that, of course, is a factual issue. The context is the jailer's training about the meaning of the emergency button, the inmate's training about the meaning of the emergency button, the fact that there's nothing in the record, the defendants introduced nothing to indicate that either Mr. Velez or any other inmate had ever abused the emergency button. And it's an emergency call complaining of a conflict. Now, Deputy Johnson had a choice point at that moment. He had a decision to make. Do I do something? Do I do nothing? If he had done something, I don't think I could be here complaining about it, even if it had been the wrong thing. But his choice was to do nothing. The threat, based on his training and his experience and the context, was conspicuous and obvious. And that's all it takes. I don't claim that Deputy Johnson wanted anybody to be hurt, but the court is quite right. We have a situation here where Mr. Velez, who's obviously not a very nice guy or he wouldn't have been there, I concede that, but he's involuntarily locked in a cell. It's after lockdown, so he can't leave the room, with a person who's being held on charges of sexual assault and battery by a prisoner. And I think the fact that he was being held on those charges, something that's significant. And when somebody who's being involuntary...
Well, then that means he has to immediately know who everybody is in the jail and what their records are and all that stuff. Why can't you just say you're going to put two people in a cell together, pretrial detainees, by the way.
I quite agree.
They press an emergency button, you better go and find out what's going on.
I quite agree. It's not a necessary fact, but it's certainly an interesting fact in light of what happened after that.
Yeah. The most interesting fact about this case is that nothing happens to the assailant in the end. How did that come about? I mean, it's not your problem, I realize, but it's interesting.
The record is not clear on that. My best inference from it is that at the time the trial was scheduled, he was still an inmate in the Milwaukee County Jail. He was subsequently sentenced on some separate charge, removed from the Milwaukee County Jail into the state prison system. I'm speculating now. And when the trial rolled around, he wasn't available to be produced, and because he had already was already serving what apparently was a 20-year sentence on some other charge, they just let it go. And again, I'm filling in a lot of blanks here. I'm not quite sure of that. But yeah, nothing happened to him. Mm-hmm. Quite frankly, although I think I have some time left, if you have no other questions, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mishlove. I believe counsel had used all of his time, had he not?
Yes, if you have something you'd like to add, I'll give you a minute.
Thank you, Judge. I would just briefly add that there was evidence in the record, by the way of an affidavit of one of the other officers on duty, that there were oftentimes requests for changes of cells or requests relating to conflicts with cellmates, and that those requests were not always genuine, and that they needed to assess the nature of the request, the level of the problem, in order to respond to them. I will concede that that does not deal directly with the issue of an emergency call, but that evidence is in there on the broader question of how often prisoners would bring up issues relating to their cellmates and problems with their cellmates. And again, I would just return to the point that I am not suggesting that Mr. Velez had to state with crystal clarity exactly what was happening in the cell, but that an officer cannot be found liable under the deliberate indifference standard, the due process clause of the 14th Amendment, simply because a prisoner indicates by emergency intercom or otherwise, I have a conflict with my cellmate. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And the case will be taken under advisement with our thanks to both counsel.